Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Collider Ladies Night. I am so excited to welcome Rose McIver to the show because her new series, Ghosts, is an utter delight, an absolute must watch. Rose, huge congratulations on Ghosts.
Thank you so much. We're so grateful and excited that people seem to love it and enjoy it. And hopefully they get a good time watching it because we want to keep making it forever.
Really. I mean, it is the definition of a good time to me. And it feels like the type of content that I need right now. So thank you for providing that.
Thank you.
So I didn't warn you about this. The first thing we do on Ladies Night is we use this dice tower behind me. Mm-hmm. I've got a list of 8 random questions here. I roll the die 3 times and whatever I land on, that's where we start at least.
Love it. Sounds great.
All right. First one up. We're going with an 8. Number 8 is, it's a fun one, game show. If you could be on the game show of your choice, what show would you pick and could you actually win it?
Oh, I would like to be on one that's pure chance. Like I want like the Wheel of Fortune level. I don't want to have to bring any expertise. I don't want trivia. I don't want any of that. I want luck. I want cold, hard luck and I will have as much of a chance as anybody else then at winning.
You would go Wheel of Fortune, you'd have the luck of the wheel. And are you good at solving puzzles like that?
You know, I'm better at that than I am at any of the Quizmaster style game shows. So I guess it's really a process of deduction. I'm like ending up with Wheel of Fortune because I know the others would not be my strong suit.
Fair enough. That's like me sucking at Jeopardy, but feeling okay about Wheel of Fortune.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right. Roll number 2 now. Got a number 5 this time, which is must-haves. What is something that you can't be on set without? Whether it is your sides, your notes, a certain snack, something to pass the time in between scenes, you name it.
It's funny you should ask because I'm quite famous for carrying everything I own with me at all times. I don't know where it comes from. Must be some sort of inherited behavior, but I carry it like just in case I'm going to need my drink bottle, my thermos, my book. I've got my script, my binder, got an iPad, and I like have it all under my arms at any given moment. And I'll move like 10 feet and I'll carry it just in case like I need it. It's just quite bizarre. It's got to be some sort of hoarding style technique.
This visual is making me feel better about myself because my friends are always picking on me because I'm always the person to go out with like everything in my hands or pockets. Like, why can't I just get a bag? I have to make it more difficult on myself for some reason.
Exactly. I've had family say it's like me carrying around all my teddy bears. It's the same sort of mentality. It's like, just in case I need all these mates.
Maybe just holding them is like a security blanket of sorts.
Exactly. I know. I'd hate to take it to a therapist.
All right. I got one more roll on the tower for you. Right now we got a number 3. Number 3 is never again. What is something that you did for a role that now looking back makes you say, I'm very glad I tried that, but never again?
Dirt boarding. I had to dirt board, which not only is just like, it's like a mountain, like wheeled snowboarding is what I would compare it to. It's like these giant tired boards that you ride down a mountain and you literally stop by crashing into a tree. That's like the, that's sort of the thing is like, well, you're going to bail at the end of the thing. So just try to bail as well as you can. But not only that, dirt board was like the hardest word I've ever said in an American accent as well. Dirt board. It was just a particularly like R forward. And actually I had to say the line, a dirt boarder's girlfriend. And I was like, couldn't get my mouth around it. So dirt boarding is a never again for me, I think. In a movie or probably in real life.
I feel like even though you're calling it a never again, that description of it kind of makes me want to try it, even though I'm sure it would break something.
For sure. For sure. I mean, I had like a 6-foot male stunt double in a long blonde wig trying to kind of make me look impressive on the slopes. And then it would cut into my like head just looking completely traumatized as I staggered off this thing. It was very strange. Very strange
what,
job.
What project was this for so I can go look it up?
Johnny Capahala Back on Board, the Disney Channel original film that we shot in New Zealand.
All right. I'm definitely going to do my homework after this. Now we get into the meat of the interview. Now we start all the way back at the very, very beginning. What is the movie, the show, the performance, personal experience, you name it, that first made you say, I have to be an actor?
I have that weird story of kind of stumbling into it as a kid. And I'm always so wary to say this because it makes my mum sound like a stage mum, and she's really, really not. My brother and I both got scouted. Well, my brother got scouted in a bank when he was like 3, just talking on one of those toy, toy phone, at like the kids play area or whatever. And some person was casting a commercial was like, oh, he's really sort of verbal. You should have him, you know, come and do this thing. And my mum was a bit like, oh, I'm not sure. And sort of ended up thinking, oh, what harm can it do? And he did like one commercial. And New Zealand is about 1 degree of separation at any given moment. So like they met somebody on this commercial shoot that said, oh, could he be in my short film? And it was always like the way kids would sort of play tennis or do ballet or anything else. It was like a hobby that we kind of, that my brother was able to do. So anyway, when he was about 4, I guess, he got put in this short film, and I was born by that point, and I was there with my mum, and they like, said, oh, you know, they're supposed to be a toddler. Would the mother be able to, you know, the actor mother character be able to hold the baby as well? Mum was like, oh, I guess, sure. And so then I was in something when I was about 2 years old. It was like a short film by a woman called Eileen O'Sullivan, who's a really wonderful New Zealand filmmaker. And then it's sort of just a steady string of like tiny little one day here and there people who knew people's projects. I was really lucky. I was in The Piano, the Jane Campion film, when I was 3, doing what, again, one day. And it's not acting when you're that old. It's like just being and just sort of hovering around. And, you know, if you're somebody who doesn't have colossal tantrums, you're going to fare better than a kid who does. So I kind of just had a bunch of incidental things like that. And then when I was at school, I was never really allowed to take significant time off school or anything. So it was always like, every now and then, once a year, I would do like a week on Xena or Hercules or something like that. Just all the shows that shot in New Zealand. And it just kind of kept happening. And I finished high school and sort of tried to do other things, but I kept coming back to it. And here we are, I'm 33, and I'm still sort of pinching myself that it's what I've ended up doing. It's very strange. It sort of crept up on me, but I can't imagine doing anything else that I enjoy as much.
Somewhat unrelated, but you have to see Power of the Dog. It's got me on a Jane kick right now. Oh my God, it's so good.
I can't wait. My sweet friend Thomasin McKenzie is in that movie.
She was actually just on Ladies Night. I think she was my last guest actually for Last Night in Soho. And she is like jaw dropping in that movie.
Oh, she's such a darling. Her mom is my acting coach who I've had since I was a teenager. So I've known Thomasin since she was 4, 5, something like that. Yeah, she's an old sweet.
That's so cool.
So amazing.
Make something together.
Oh God, yeah, just I'll do what I can, you know, from your lips to God's ears.
I like to manifest things. Mm-hmm. All right. So we've got the story of how you kind of fell into acting and got that momentum going. But do you remember the first time that you realized you needed to act in terms of, you know, when a performance just felt so right that it became more than a career goal, but rather, you know, a feeling, a creative feeling that you needed to keep having?
Yeah, the standout for me, funnily, was Xena. When I was 9, I did an episode of Xena where it was when Lucy Lawless was pregnant and she needed a light episode. So they wrote this episode where her soul gets put into the body of a little girl. I can't even remember quite what the conceit was. But anyway, I played Xena, but in the 9-year-old girl's body. And it was the first time where it was really taking something on. I remember Lucy generously like recorded all of these cassettes that I still have of her doing the war cry or her talking about, you know, choices that she's made as the character, and just was really generous. And that was the first time, yeah, it would have been 9, where I got to do pretty extensive stunts. I got to do like a flip on a harness, and I just found the like taking over something and really getting lost in somebody else and building a character. It wasn't just saying words. It wasn't there was kind of a lot of planning, and I liked that, you know, sort of structuring a character and coming up with ideas for it. And yeah, that was the first time mimicking her, you know, I was kind of able to try to do a bit of impersonating, and it was really kind of eye-opening. And I thought, this is so deeply creative, because I think I'd often thought of acting as you're channeling somebody else's creativity, you're bringing somebody else's words to the screen, you're doing, kind of you're a vehicle for somebody else's idea. And this was the first time I was like, oh, there's very significant creative input you can have as well.
You name drop the best people, because Lucy Lawless is another one who I just like absolutely adore. And she's always such a wonderful interview, just talks about everything with such passion. And that makes my job very easy and very fulfilling.
She's incredible. She's so inspiring. I think she's, you know, she was so ahead of her time in the work she was doing, and the way she used her platform. And I'm a big fan, big fan.
All right, let's make a jump to Power Rangers now, because I grew up mighty obsessed with Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And I just have like a million questions about the reality of playing a Power Ranger. So maybe let's go with a twofold one here. What is something specific to Power Rangers that no other set that you've ever been on needed or did in terms of the production process and what it takes to bring a show like that to screen? And then what's something about working on that show that you find coming in handy even now, something that might have, you know, surprised you to still have an impact on you moving forward?
So one of the things that was uniquely Power Rangers was, I mean, when else do you ever go to work and fight giant monsters in rubber suits? Like even now, I'm sure, I don't know how they shoot it now, whether how much of it is CGI or mocap or what they could possibly do to do it differently. But at the time, it was literally, you don't see that, you know, when people shoot these big Marvel movies and things, it's people covered in dots and, you know, in costume, in sort of green suits or in black suits or whatever. This was like literally somebody chucks on a giant rubber head and fights in like the New Zealand sun and humidity on a beach, like down the street from where I grew up. And it was just such a uniquely practical show, I thought. Like it's not as much in post-production as you would imagine. It's really putting on giant costumes. It kind of feels very theatrical. And so I would put on, every time I put on my Power Rangers helmet, a really wonderful Japanese guy would perform all my stunts. He had like breast pads and hip pads and things, and he would do everything impressive. And then I pull the helmet off and it's me, and I'm sort of like, you can always see a difference between who's who, but you pull the helmet off and like finish out the moves, or you know, you've just fallen off a bike and you stand up. And so I was really picking up the tail ends and pieces of everybody else's really hard work. But it was just fascinating. It was such a unusual experience. The ADR for that show, that's the one thing I don't miss, was just vocal burnout, like nonstop for like hours each week. And the thing that I have taken away that I still use is I was always amazed because it's such a huge stunt component. So there are these really well-trained stunt teams that were there and they would use like the tiniest moments. They'd have like 2 minutes off and they'd lie down and do sit-ups or like star jumps or something, this incidental, like squeezing in conditioning. Maybe this is just my excuse so that I don't have to dedicate like a full hour a day to doing any kinds of workouts, but it is impressive what you can accumulate when you do like little tiny pieces, especially in like a busy shooting schedule or whatever. There's not really an excuse not to like do sort of 10 sit-ups every now and then or something that just makes you feel engaged with your body. And especially when you're on set for significant stretches of time and you can really just rely on, you get so cerebral and so out of your body. Like it's quite nice to just do little things that remind you you're in a little meat suit yourself.
I totally get that. I feel like that kind of mentality took over during the pandemic when we were all stuck at home and I was just sitting in a computer chair all day. It made it very easy to kind of, you know, take like 10 minutes at a time to do a virtual core class or something. Before you know it, it adds up to something that's really helping you to train.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be this, you know, we kind of are, I can be quite binary about like, I'm in the mindset where I'm doing a ton of exercise or I'm not. And it's kind of that nice reminder that like little bits creeping in here and there add up and can make you feel a little bit more engaged. It's not about, you know, anything other than just sort of, I don't know, getting outside your head, I find helpful.
Let's go to Lovely Bones now. So that was the first thing that I ever saw you in. And I feel like it is kind of often classified as a breakout project for you. But I want to know, did it truly feel that way to you when that movie came out? Could you feel, you know, the momentum pick up, the doors open? Or is that more of a, you know, a dreamlike scenario of what happens when you have your first big Hollywood project?
It was the most surreal year of my life, maybe until 2020. I take that back. But at the time I was 19, I had just finished high school. I was 18 when I auditioned, I guess. I just finished high school and I auditioned. I went in with like greasy hair. I'd literally come from the gym or from a workout or something. And I think I just thought it was such a long shot. I didn't get dressed up. I didn't do anything. I just was wearing like my leggings and my yoga top or whatever I was in. And scraped back hair in a ponytail and put down this tape and kind of didn't overthink it. And then assumed nothing was going to happen. And about 2 months later, got a kind of cold call out of nowhere saying, can you come down and meet Peter Jackson in Wellington tomorrow kind of thing. And I did. And actually when I flew down was when I met Miranda, who's Thomas and Mackenzie's mum. Miranda Harcourt was coaching on that film. And I met her and it suddenly all felt like it was kind of a callback, but it was a read through. It was this sort of surreal experience. And I had planned to do what in New Zealand we call your OE. It's like your overseas experience. And your first year out of high school, you often go and do like backpacking in Thailand or Europe or something. And I had booked this trip and we were camping through Eastern Europe, me and two girlfriends. And it still felt like enough of a long, like, even though I'd got this callback, I kind of was like, I don't want to miss this trip and, you know, say no to this. And then not, then the job doesn't work out and I end up just with nothing to do. So I still went on the trip. And I remember it was way pre cell phones that as we have them now and our plans that we have now, and it cost a fortune to call internationally. So I just had like a $20 top up card with like texts on it. And I got texted from my agent in New Zealand halfway through that trip telling me I'd booked it. And I was like camping in Bosnia or something at the time and didn't even get on the phone about it. It was just like, yes, it's come through. And I think we even negotiated via text. Like they came up with the deal and everything. And it was really weird. But it was completely life-changing for me. I went and filmed in Pennsylvania for 3 months and got to work with, you know, the New Zealand royalty, Peter Jackson and Fran and Philippa. And we shot this film that I'm proud of. I mean, I love the novel so much. I'm very attached to those characters and that story. And it was, yeah, completely surreal and remarkable. And I mean, even just being in filming in American high schools, it's the stuff that I'd seen on television growing up so much, and cafeterias and cheerleading teams. And we were filming and we went and researched in amongst these things. it was just, I mean, the most fish out of water kind of experience that I've had, but it was wonderful. And then I went home and life just kind of goes on, you know. The film didn't come out for another year after that. And I remember people saying to me, you should stay in LA now. And this is, and it just all felt so strange and kind of whimsical. And I didn't know whether there was, I didn't really buy that it was going to go anywhere. I don't know. I didn't want to count my chickens before they hatched. So I went back home and I started at university and didn't have very much discipline at university and kind of stuck around there a bit. Worked in like retail for a year or two, the equivalent of like Forever 21 or whatever. I just got a job, just had a sort of weird year where I was first year out of high school, kind of learning how to be an adult. And then the film came out and then I sort of started getting a few more opportunities. And it's still, I mean, the move out to LA, I moved out to LA a year after that. It wasn't like I swanned in and every door was open. I mean, I was so lucky that it did create definitely some opportunities, but I still got out here and, you know, I had to battle to find a flat and take weird music video jobs in the desert and, you know, just try to cobble something together and work out why I'd left home. And it's kind of been, I never really am convinced that it's like all sorted now. And now my career is going to be great. It's like, I keep kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop at some point and be like, well, good to have. No, but it's true. You feel like that. I don't think anything's a given. And I think it's a nice way to feel. I feel really appreciative that everything that comes along still feels so exciting to me, that I still kind of, I'm aware what a privilege it is to do this job. And that it could go away because these things can. It's nice. It's really important to me.
That feeling is inevitable when you find something that you do and you truly love. I mean, yeah. I feel that every single day and I wouldn't want to live a day of my life any other way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just know how insanely rare that is on this planet to be able to do that. So kind of, it is quite a surreal thing when you stop and think about it.
Oh, absolutely. All right, let's jump over to Once Upon a Time. I'm curious with that one. Is there anything about jumping into a show like that with, you know, such a massive and powerful fan base that maybe wound up helping you prepare for the enthusiasm that you would eventually experience when you went on to headline iZombie?
Yeah, very much. I mean, I had a great time on that show. It was incredible to get to play Tinkerbell, play this kind of icon that, you know, I'd known as a kid, and then you're suddenly getting to embody that as an adult. It's a really special feeling. The fan base for that show is unreal. It is so supportive, and I have sort of weirdly fallen into just so much genre in my life, between Power Rangers and Xena and Hercules and Once Upon a Time and iZombie and everything. It's like I do seem to kind of fall into these shows, work into these shows where there's just like a very creative community that support them, and people who do a lot of like their own cosplays and fan fiction and illustrations. And it's been a really, it's not a show. None of these have been shows that people kind of just disengage or, you know, watch and kind of leave afterwards. It's like, it seems to kind of build this collective creative thing that happens out of them. And I mean, I've done so many conventions over the years and I'm always just blown away by people's dedication. I love the idea that people have met community through these kinds of shows and found other people like-minded on the internet. It's like the best parts of the internet, that somebody who could feel kind of isolated in their own life suddenly taps into this vein of like people who like the same things that they do. And I think it's kind of a showcase of some of the best things about people. Like when you go to a convention and you see people from all over the world who've met online in these forums and really encourage each other. And it's very touching, I think.
It's one of the absolute top reasons why I can't wait for that kind of convention environment to come back. I feel like I've been too far removed from it from too long. And, you know, I miss that, that kind of face-to-face interaction with that community.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And just the imagination in it too. Like you kind of, there's a childlike imagination that we're allowed to still tap into as adults when we get into a show like that. And I don't know, that's refreshing, especially right now.
Oh, absolutely. What about the idea of just headlining your own series? Because at that point you had been on so many sets. So on those past projects, TV or film, was there anyone who was, you know, the big star or number one on the call sheet that did something to set the tone on set that when you hit iZombie, you're like, I want to bring that to my set now?
Yeah, I think I had done a show in New Zealand when I was a teenager called Madigan's Quest. It's another genre show. It's like a traveling circus, post-apocalyptic traveling circus. So dime a dozen. And I played a tightrope walker in that. And I was the lead in that show when I was 15. And that, even though that was, you know, obviously a much smaller scale and filmed in New Zealand and had a lot of people I knew who were involved, I had had the experience of the day in, day out sort of machinery of what it is to lead a show and just the sheer kind of the work hours, the prep that you need to do. I kind of built some of my processes a little bit on that, I think, and sort of figured out what's important and who in the crew does what and how to kind of, you know, make sure everybody feels heard. And that sort of set me up in a really interesting way, I think, back in New Zealand. And there's a few actors who I worked with in New Zealand. There's a lady called Danielle Cormack who was on that show actually too. She's an Australian actor who did a show called Wentworth for the last sort of 10 years or something. She's a Kiwi actor who did a show in Australia. But anyway, there was lots of people like her who I looked up to as a kid, and I just thought, she's we did like 6 projects together in New Zealand, and I think I remember looking at her approach to building characters, and she was definitely a standout to me, where I thought, she was never too good or too cool for anything or too, she just gave so much of herself to everything she did, and she cared a lot. And I think I've never been cool is not my thing. I would rather not be too. I'm like okay with being sort of more interested in doing a good job and trying and putting myself out there and maybe embarrassing myself and failing, which has happened plenty, than like just worrying about how I come across. So I think I took that going into iZombie was just like, this is a crazy opportunity. It's, I know I'd been in LA long enough and knew how hard people work to try to get jobs like this. And they're rare as hen's teeth when it's going to be working with people you love and on a script that you love. And so I was really ready, and I was ready to take it seriously and try to build upon the things that I'd learned. And so I put quite a lot of myself into that show for 5 years, and so did everybody who worked on it. I mean, our crew were incredible. I think it's like just, I was very lucky. I was very supported by the people who I worked with, and vice versa. I think we all, knew that it's a vulnerable thing to kind of be trying to figure yourself out and do this for the first time on a big sort of, for us, it was like a, you know, big network show that we'd never done anything like, most of us. So there's kind of a, it helps when you all feel like you're doing it together. You're all kind of looking out for each other. And yeah, so I booked it. I did an audition and like booked it. These things happen so fast when you get a pilot. I was very excited, but you kind of don't really know what the show is. You don't know. I sort of said, yes, I'll do this. Great. And then suddenly I'm in Vancouver for the next 5 years based on a decision made within 24 hours. And I just felt so lucky that was the one that it could happen to, because it could be anything, you know, could be somewhere I didn't like with people I didn't sort of understand or get along with as well. So felt like that was kind of a dream scenario to get that job.
Bringing up the process of, you know, making a pilot and then getting it picked up, how did maybe the iZombie experience and other shows that you've done compare to what Ghosts was like? Because, you know, you make the pilot, and then I know that there were production changes when you finally got picked up, where it's, you know, not in the same house. And then on top of that, we just find out that you get picked up for the full series. So is that basically the standard, or is there anything unique about the process of working with CBS on Ghost that made that process unique?
Well, this last 2 years obviously has changed the whole rhythm of everything. So it was very strange. We did our read through, our big table read. We hadn't cast Jay's role, my husband's role. We did a read through on a Friday, and we were due to start shooting on the Monday, still missing 3 characters, I think, trying to worry about getting them cast over the weekend. And after the read through that afternoon was when national emergency was declared and everything shut down. And so everybody said at the time, oh, it'll be 2 weeks. And then we all know what happened. And so it was they can be kind of a long gestation process anyway, where it's like you make the pilot and then you wait and find out what's going to happen. But this was like read through in March, shot the pilot in December, got picked up the next March, started shooting the next July. It felt like by the time we got on set to shoot the first season, it felt like a sort of 6-year reunion or something. I don't know. Like everybody had been communicating so much. Everybody knew each other. In a way that I think really served the show, because especially in a first season, you're normally building rapport still with your fellow actors and kind of finding your dynamics. And we had all, whether it was just on Zoom or text or whatever, we kind of had really started to get a rhythm between us, and we'd all understood a little bit how we each work and what's funny and what, you know, who we each kind of play as the pieces of this jigsaw puzzle. So that was actually, that was a weird, very positive element of it. But yeah, very, very strange sort of drawn out experience to get to where we are. And we're all just like, it's surreal. We're on a 2-week hiatus right now, about to shoot the final 5 episodes of the season. And I mean, just so happy people seem to resonate with it. And you can spend 2 years building something up and then it could be a disaster and nobody kind of likes it or engages. So we're all pinching ourselves. It seems to be landing.
It's like an undeniable joy. Like I find it to be one of those things where I want to go up to someone and say like, watch this. And I dare you not to smile. Try not to smile at least once during the show. It is just that kind of, you know, like an infectious, warm family type vibe. And, you know, it also boasts a really ingenious concept too, that it's got like a wish fulfillment quality, and we will get to that.
That's so nice of you to say. That's really lovely. Yeah. We feel like, it's hopefully there's somebody who makes you smile at least, and somebody you identify with. And there's such a great mixed bag of cast. The characters are all, you know, from such different eras and cultures and demographics. And it's just, hopefully there's somebody for everybody to feel like they identify with. And it might be somebody who surprises you too, who might not be who you expect.
What about the production challenges of shooting a show like this? Because, you know, you got one character who can see the ghosts, someone else who does not. Does that mean you have to almost shoot everything twice in order to get both versions of what the room is looking like?
Yes, we do. We mainly cover it with everybody there. That's basically how we treat it. And then we do one pass because we shoot in Montreal. They say sans fantôme instead of ghostless, but it's the sans fantôme pass, which is when they all get out and it's just Utkarsh and I, if we're both in the scene. And, you know, there's tricks with both sides of it. Like it's trickier for me when everybody's gone and I'm still trying to remember whose eyelines to play to. But for him, he has to ignore them all of the time anyway. So, and he has to do that for longer stretches than I do. You know, his challenge is for the majority of the footage. Mine is just in a few of the shots. So it is a technical show. It's a very technical show. There's a big cast with, you know, lots of improvisers in there, people trying to work out how to find each other, how to find our moments, when to pipe up, when not. And it's just getting stronger and stronger, I think. Like, I'm in awe of some of the skills that I'm surrounded by every day. And I'm not from an improv background. That's something that I'm enjoying a lot, but it's not what I was trained in. So being with these kind of pros who have just done that their whole lives, it's phenomenal to watch and lots to learn.
I truly would not know that just from watching the show. Your timing is impeccable. The timing and the tone is always spot on for everyone. So with Sam in particular, I'm wondering if there's any particular, you know, a scene or a beat earlier on in season one that kind of helped really put the character into perspective for you.
Yeah, I think at the end of the second episode where I walk in and say, okay, I can see you all. I identify everybody in the room. I say, I'm done trying to pretend you don't exist now. But what do you need? Like, what do you need? And that sums Sam up for me, is like, she's sort of the family therapist in my mind. And she kind of is trying to make sure everybody can get along. Everybody gets what they need. She's calling people out on their behavior when she doesn't like it. But she's also, you know, she's just as partial as anybody else to being sucked into the drama too. And it is a very managerial quality to her. And I think that summed it up, where it was her control issues tend to be, I think, always rooted in her wanting everybody to be happy all the time in the show. So she gets it wrong for sure, and we see that more and more. But I think I can empathize with her reasons for trying to kind of corral all of these crazy roommates into some sort of semblance of like cohesion.
With that being a really strong core quality of the character, do you ever find it difficult to tackle story points where she's making a purely selfish decision? I was just watching the flower episode, and at one point I didn't imagine her taking the plunge and doing that, but I feel like you also convey the drive with her career to kind of make me understand why. But is when you read a script like that, is there any moment where you're like, this isn't what she would do and this is not what I want her to do?
Well, our job as an actor is to figure out how it is what she would do. It's like, you know, there are very sort of specific circumstances where you might go, this really doesn't make sense to me. But most of the time we're all such contradictory beings, like we all are a bit of this and a bit of that. And I even think with the episode with Flower, where she's, you know, wanting to kind of sell this article that is not, you know, is going against what her friend and roommate has asked her to do, but I play it from a place of people pleasing. She's trying to please the editor. She's like worried that she's not enough for him, that she's worried that she's trying to keep somebody else happy and deliver something that then she, you know, it's the same person to me. You can find a way in with most of those things. And it's not to say, even though I talk about her a lot as being very accommodating, and it's a show about accommodation, and she's trying to accommodate the people around her a lot. And within that, I think there's room for selfish behaviors, or behaviors that, even though she might think she's doing the right thing, definitely set back the team a little bit.
It's such an interesting character to explore in this. I think it's an interesting character to explore in any genre, because it's, you know, it's someone who has the foundation of always being good and doing the right things and not being able to process when something is selfish or wrong. And it just makes for a far more complex way to add layers to a character.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely close to home for me, a sense of like, when you're trying to please, you cannot please everybody all of the time. So it's sort of about rewiring yourself. Like, you know, hopefully throughout the show, she sort of has to learn how to let her values lead her rather than her desire to keep everybody happy. And that, you know, maybe then there's moments of conflict, but there will hopefully be less absolute kind of dissolving of the community, which is what's happening several times already, as we've seen in the show.
Off topic, but have you ever seen Sex Education?
I haven't seen it yet. Do I need to?
There's a great people pleaser through line in episode in season 3 that is just incredibly effective. Oh. And, you know, two completely different types of comedy, but I could see some similarities in both. Oh, and it's very effective.
Thank you.
Yeah, highly recommend. This next, like, I don't even have a good question about this next thing, but Jurassic Park is my favorite movie of all time. So just like round of applause for all of those A+ Jurassic Park references in that episode.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the writers gave so much magic to work with, but Utkash was definitely improvising on that as well. And, you know, credit where credit's due for both of them, because when they create these strong scripts, I do think sometimes when we talk about how much the cast improvise, I'm wary of making it sound like we're not given this incredible material to begin with, which we are. I think it really speaks to the confidence of the Joes, the showrunners, the co-writers, when they're able to bring something so, so strong to us and then really confidently know that if there's a way that somebody can improve it, then throw it in, because it's only ever going to enhance the product. So yeah, I feel really lucky that we're given an incredible launch pad, but then some creative freedom as well for if there's moments like Utkash happens to be a Jurassic Park nut. So he had some really great stuff up his sleeves.
I love that so much. All right, before I let you go, we have one more game to play, and we're going to lean into the wish fulfillment quality of ghosts a little bit here. We are going to build your very own ghost-filled house. And the first thing we need to do is we need to have you pinpoint a location. What type of home do you want, and where in the world do you want it to be?
Oh, you know, I've been out of New Zealand for a long time and I'm pretty homesick. So I'm going to say Piha Beach is my favorite beach in New Zealand. It's like a big black sand, wild surf beach. It's very close to where I grew up.
Sounds like an excellent choice to me. So now you can have a ghost from the past living with you. Anyone you want. Who do you pick and why?
Maybe like, I like the idea of like a relative from like 10 generations ago. Really go back there. Somebody that, I mean, I'm just amazed. Us being here is evidence that something they did worked, that we survived, you know. Maybe some sort of inherited like wisdom from somebody 10 generations ago. That's what I'd take.
This next one I'm calling the entertainment ghost, because I feel like there's great value in having a ghost on hand who can just offer some good entertainment, no matter the form. But I guess I kind of have to get dark with this one. So you can lure a favorite performer to this home and, you know, do what needs to be done to turn him into a ghost. Who do you pick and why?
I am going to take, who am I going to take? Maybe like, this is so tricky. Hang on. I'll take T Murph, who I worked with on Woke, a show a couple of years ago. His name's T Murph. He's a comedian from Chicago, and he is just a joke machine. That guy is like just one liner after one liner after one liner. I feel like you could literally, I would want to be able to check out a little at this, you know, ghost house and just kind of watch and get like not have to engage too much. And I feel like you could turn him on like a television and just watch. So that's what I would do.
Smart pick right there. This next one is the ghost. You can take one ghost from the show and have them live with you. Who do you pick?
I think I pick, probably Richie, Pete, because he's just so optimistic. He'd be so, you know, he'd be able to find the silver lining in any cloud. I'd take that. Yeah.
All right. Smart one there too. This next thing is, I'm just going to call it TV time. So the ghosts on ghost, like binging shows. So if everyone wanted to be binging a show, what show would you want them to pick so that you could enjoy it as well?
I would pick Love on the Spectrum. That's my favorite show. Have you seen Love on the Spectrum?
I have never seen it, but I've heard great things.
It's so good. And again, just showcasing some of the best, most like heartful, beautiful sides of humanity. It just makes me feel really good, that show. Yeah, that's what
I like that. All right, so this last one is your best friend to live in the house with you. You can invite a real life friend to come live there because they are the most likely person to believe you when you tell them that you could see ghosts. Who is that friend?
That friend would be Jennifer Morrison, who is from Once Upon a Time. She, you know, the amount that we had to believe on that show, I remember her talking about having to really invest in the belief in this, the powers of like this coconut that she carried around as like a handbag or something. The amount that she's had to suspend like reality and believe things in that show. She's also like one of my best friends. So I think that she would be kind of able to get on board and be earnest and commit to like, all right, this is happening. She'd take me seriously, I think.
I think you built a pretty good house there. I would definitely love to like come over, hang out and experience some of this. So job very well done.
Perfect.
I do have to let you go now.
Aww.
But before we say goodbye, huge, huge, huge congratulations on Ghost and also everything that you've accomplished. But for right now, to anybody out there who has not done the Ghosts binge, trust me when I tell you, it will be such a wonderful source of light in your life. You will love it. Please check it out. And again, Rose, congratulations on this and everything. And I hope to have you on Ladies Night again soon.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I hope to as well.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.